until I showed up in that hospital, I had no idea that I was a patient. I thought I was just visiting. As I was growing up, getting married and raising kids, I'm like, I'm going to tell them the truth. The day that I had the surgery to replace the aneurysm, it was kind of funny. I said, I could pass a flight physical today and nobody would be the wiser.
Genetics isn't always black and white, and the emotions and decisions surrounding genetics and genetic testing can be even more complex. Welcome to Patient Stories with Gray Genetics. I'm Eleanor Griffith, certified genetic counselor and the founder of Gray Genetics, an independent telehealth genetic counseling and consulting service. It seems like there are constantly headlines in the news about genetics, but few news stories focus on the patient experience. At Gray Genetics, we are collecting patient stories, your stories. Every other Tuesday, we bring you a patient story related to genetics. If you'd like to share your story, send an email to podcast@graygenetics.com.
I had to wait until I grew my own genetic counselor to start learning about this. And it's amazing how similar our stories are, even though the diseases are totally unrelated. It's the same journey.
Hello, my name is Tina Inman, and I'm a second-year genetic counseling student at Sarah Lawrence College. I had the pleasure of speaking with Dave Jacob about his incredible story that he shares with his daughter, Dawn Laney, a certified genetic counselor and professor at Emory School of Medicine. Thank you both for sharing, and I hope you enjoy listening.
Dave Jacob is the founder of Think Genetic, Inc. and of the Think Genetic Foundation. The Think Genetic Foundation is a 501c co-founded in 2016 with Professor Dawn Laney, a board-certified genetic counselor at Emory School of Medicine, and Dave's own daughter. Dave, thank you for joining me today.
You're welcome.
And you were diagnosed with a heart defect as a child, and it was later found after a winding journey that you have a rare disorder called cutis laxa. Can we start with your childhood diagnosis and go from there?
Sure. So I was a birth defect baby, is the way it was described. So I had a hole in my heart that actually was a valve that was supposed to close that didn't close. And so we knew we were going to have to do something if I was going to make it out of childhood. And my sister, who was born 5 years later, still has the same condition. So it's kind of interesting to have two of us in the same family. And I have two other sisters. So one that's 2 years younger than me, than Carol, my sister with the condition, is 5 years younger. And then a third sister who is another 5 years after that. So my parents decided no more children. It was every other one. And so my problem was had a very rapid heart rate because of the hole, and my mother was always trying to keep me from running and doing anything else. Personally, as a kid, I didn't know there was anything wrong. And of course, in those days, doctors didn't talk about the fact that I had a problem, and I didn't realize that I was sick until I was taken. I grew up in northern Florida in a town called Panama City, northwest panhandle of Florida. And so the surgery was scheduled in Birmingham, Alabama, at the University Hospital there. Until I showed up in that hospital, I had no idea that I was a patient. I thought I was just visiting. And I still remember, I mean, it was very traumatic. I was five when they decided to do the surgery. And it wasn't experimental, but it was fairly new. So I was there for some period of time. I don't know how long, because I just didn't know time in those days. But I remember after the surgery, waking up in my bed, and there was nobody in the room with me, and there was this giant tube coming down into my chest. Looks like blood. It was red. And the only thing I could think of is, I want to get this thing out of me, and I don't know why I'm here. And when I went to remove it, I was tied down to the bed. So I think that was probably the scariest day of my life, still is when I think about it, that there's no, without any understanding of what was happening. But after I made it through that, and they took a rib out to do the surgery, that's the way it was done in those days. Interestingly enough, when my sister had her surgery, they didn't have to remove the rib to get at the heart to do the surgery. But I had a normal childhood after that. I am very athletic, and fortunately, I don't remember anything after that. My parents never talked about it, and they just said, be a normal kid. So I was. Played all sports, football, basketball, baseball, etc. growing up. So other than I had a problem with respiratory issues. And I can remember many nights when my mom would put me in this thing in the kitchen where I would stick my head in this bag and it was steaming. So it was kind of like, she said it was whooping cough, but I don't have any idea. But that was the only symptom that I had following on as a kid.
So, did you have like symptoms of asthma? Was it maybe treatment for that?
Could have been, I don't know. Again, parents didn't talk much about those kind of things, and the doctor never said anything that I remember. So those are two things I remember, is a rapid heart rate and then having my head in this bag trying to catch my breath growing up. And that went away later. By middle school, all of that was gone, so I didn't think any more about it.
Things weren't like really explained to you at like a higher level when you were a kid, even though you were experiencing it. And I'm guessing you had to sort of piece together what was going on once you were older and kind of look back on that.
Yeah, I had a lot of. It's interesting what it causes, because even when I was before the surgery, when they were prepping me for surgery, they were saying, we're going to do something, and don't worry about it. It's not going to hurt, and you'll be okay. And so that stuck with me for a lot of years. You couldn't get me to a doctor's office. I wanted nope. I didn't trust anybody because I didn't know, and it did hurt. You can say what you want. It hurt. So anyway.
Yeah, it left a real impression
It
on
really
you.
did. Yeah. I mean that as I was growing up, getting married and raising kids, I'm like, I'm going to tell them the truth. I don't care if they want to hear it or not. They need to know. If they're hurt, they're hurt. Unfortunately, they didn't have anything quite like that, but yeah, I think it makes a difference. You don't have to tell all the intricate details to children of what's going on, but you need to have at least some basic understanding of what's going on. So yeah, that's kind of been a mission of mine through my whole adult life, is to educate people, and hopefully when I speak to various conferences and things, I bring that up, that you need to be straight with your patients. Doesn't matter how old they are. They know a lot more than you think they know, and it will affect them by what you tell. What you say is going to matter. So,
Right, you know firsthand.
right.
Later on in life, you were diagnosed with an aortic aneurysm.
Right. So that's an interesting story in itself. So I had no symptoms. In fact, having gotten drafted and gone through Naval Flight School, I was in it would be described as perfect health. And when I turned 60, I was actually in Atlanta teaching a class. I did a lot of work for IBM in those days, and visiting my daughter, who was having my first grandson. That happens to be the genetic counselor, Dawn. And I started feeling sick toward the end of the class, and I thought I had a cold, maybe the flu. And so at the end of the class, I'm in Atlanta, I live in Boston, so I flew back to Boston, and it got worse. So I went to the emergency room, and they diagnosed me with double pneumonia and said, "You're going to be laying down for a few weeks." And so I did that, still not thinking anything else. And at the end of that treatment, I was still having trouble recovering, so they decided to do a chest X-ray, and that's when they found the aneurysm. And it was at that point 4.2 centimeters in diameter. I didn't know what that meant, didn't know what it was, but I knew that it was heart related. So I called my sister that had the same surgery as me and said, "Sis, you need to go get an echocardiogram. I'm just curious." And so she did that, and she had the same aneurysm. So that's when Dawn woke up and said, "I think this could be genetic." So she put her training to good use, and we started trying to figure out what it was, because it was not obvious to anybody. And we did. So she came home that Christmas and said, "I've taken a class at Emory, and I can now draw blood." So everybody in the family sit down on the couch, and she drew all our blood and sent it off to get genetically tested, and it came back with some sort of indeterminate connective tissue disorder, and that's all we knew at that point. But I'm a patient at Mass General at this point, and they're evaluating the aneurysm and telling me when it gets to 5 centimeters in diameter, they will have to go in and replace that part of my aorta. So that took 15 years, and there wasn't really any treatment, although they gave me a Losartan, which is a blood pressure medication, which in itself was kind of interesting, because I have low blood pressure, which is probably one of the reasons that I'm still here and that the aneurysm didn't burst or dissect. And they said, "We don't know if this will work, but in some patients it slows down the growth of the aneurysm." So did it slow it down or not? I don't know. But it took 15 years to get to the surgery level, which was 2 years ago now. But Dawn sent me to Johns Hopkins to see Dr. Hal Dietz, who's the head of connective tissue disorders at Johns Hopkins, expert in the field of connective disorders. And they started evaluating me for related diseases, Marfan's, Ehlers-Danlos, other related diseases like that. And we went through the whole battery of tests for, I don't know, they did about every test. I used every machine in the hospital, I think. And at the end of that, they said, well, connective tissue disorders have up to 10 symptoms, and you have three of the symptoms. And the three were obviously my aneurysm. My eyes are wider than normal, although not unusual to look at. It's just for some reason that matters. And I have velvety skin, which was a big thing to them, which I didn't even know what that meant. But I have very smooth skin. Mm-hmm. And they said, so you're in the right place. It's connective, but it's not one of the ones we've ever heard of. And so it took another 3 years, and they found an additional, they didn't resequence me, but they found another mutation that was related, and they were finally able to diagnose cutis laxa. And at that point, there weren't a lot of people that had been diagnosed with cutis laxa. I mean, I think in our support group, we had like less than 20 people. Mm-hmm. And the University of Pittsburgh was doing, strangely enough, a clinical study on cutis laxa patients. And Dawn heard about that, so she sent me to Pittsburgh, and I was in that group. And that's the first time I met people that had the condition I had. And I was by far the least severe, other than the heart problem. It has all kinds of other ramifications around loose skin and various other issues. If you look up cutis laxa, you can kind of get an idea what it looks like. I look, and compared to them, very normal. it was very eye-opening for me to see what we were faced with and what some of the other things were. Now that support group has grown to about 500. So we find about a new patient every month or so, and it's always sort of like my story. It just kind of happens. Somebody knows somebody, you meet somebody, you know, I don't know. It's certainly not medically diagnosed. That's not the way you find it at this point. So that was very eye-opening to me, and that really led to the formation of Think Genetic, because I couldn't find any information about rare diseases and cutis laxa in particular. There's just nothing out there. And the internet was just not helpful. It would always direct me to a site like the American Heart Association or something to deal with respiration. So very high level, like if you go to WebMD or something, you would get a very broad thing, but it never would die. You'd never be able to put in your symptoms to get down to the fact that it might be genetic. And that was the part that puzzled me. So I thought, well, I'm going to do something about that and try and build some content that potential patients can use, written in plain English. So we have about 300 conditions that are out on the site now. I would like to have all, however many there are now. I think the last number I saw was 9,000, so that you can at least start getting some information about what it might be, so that you can talk to your doctor or get tested, that kind of thing. So get to a genetic counselor. I mean, that's the first thing, right? But nobody ever thinks of that first. So there's right. a lot to be done with that.
Right.
So that's the story.
Yeah, this journey started because of an incidental finding, right?
Totally incidental, yeah. Go ahead.
You had been feeling kind of poorly, and I think up until then had never suspected that there was anything else underlying. Is that right?
That's true. And in fact, the day that I had the surgery to replace the aneurysm, I was kind of funny. I said I could pass a flight physical today and nobody would be the wiser, because I inherited low blood pressure from my mom, I assume, not from my dad, because that's where the problem side was. So I just had, there was no way to know. There was nothing that could alert. I didn't have heart murmurs. I didn't have valves pop. I had nothing. Nothing that you could put your hand on to say, oh, you've got something serious going on. So I felt like the day I had surgery, I was never going to be as active as I was on that day after that. And that's been fairly true. It's a long recovery from that kind of surgery. And at this point, I feel good. I can pretty much do everything. I can't do it for as long. And part of that, of course, is I'm now 76 years old. So that certainly is a part of it. But I feel like I'm healthy now and can do all the things that I used to do, just not as often.
That's really great to hear. That my father is around your age as well. And
yeah.
I think maybe that's some of the, when I heard about your story, I think some of it did hit home for me a little bit. So I'm glad to hear some of these details. I'm also curious, because you never suspected that you might have had an underlying condition, especially not one that might have been inherited.
Right.
What was it like when your daughter, who was a genetic counselor, turned to you, put these pieces together and said, okay, my aunt has this, my dad has this, what are the chances? And she said, you know, Dad, I think this might be a genetic condition. What was your reaction?
Well, I was concerned because it's like, you know, I have 3 children and 5 grandsons. At that point, I didn't have any. But it's like, well, what am I passing on? And what effect is it going to have? And then what? I don't know what to do because I don't have any information. I don't know what it is. But I understand genetics, and, you know, there had been enough stuff in other areas, like you hear about breast cancer and the BRCA gene, and those were kind of common things. And I'm going, well, that's genetic. Is that what they're talking about? Is it that kind of thing? Or what is it? So it's just lack of information, lack of knowledge. So I couldn't make an informed decision, but it certainly made me pause. And I certainly was worried about my sister. So her aneurysm, by the way, is much smaller than mine. And I think I attribute that to the fact that I was a Navy pilot. So I put a lot of strain on my heart for a few years. And that probably accelerated the growth of the aneurysm. So her aneurysm is a couple of centimeters in diameter, and she'll probably never have to have surgery. It's not growing, but it is there. So, it's related. So, yeah, it's like it makes you rethink your whole life periodically. It's like, well, why did I make that choice? And isn't it great that I didn't choose the Navy as my long career as a Navy pilot? Because I probably wouldn't have made it. Because that aneurysm doesn't, the thing about aneurysms is they don't tell you anything until they dissect, right? There's no warning.
Right.
So that always made me feel like I've been pretty lucky in the overall picture of things. And just getting diagnosed was, you know, it's like, oh my goodness.
I imagine it was shocking in a number of ways. And I'm wondering if, like, there was any sense of identity that you struggled with, knowing, like, okay, I have been healthy, I have been able to do these sports, I have been a Navy pilot, and now I'm at risk for an aortic dissection, having a risk of passing away unexpectedly or without any warning. I think some people come across this in the same way you might, where they have an incidental, they have an X-ray, or they have other symptoms that bring them to the hospital, and it's completely unexpected. Wondering if there were any strong feelings about that.
Yeah, I think I grew up as a 5-year-old that, once I realized what had happened, I realized that they had delayed the surgery for 5 years because they basically said, we want to make sure you're big enough to survive this. So I never knew what damage was done to my heart. So that was always in the back of my mind growing up that, you know, when is that going to show back up? And my dad died of a massive stroke at 57. So that's kind of interesting. That was my hardest year as an adult, was my 50s, because I was just like my dad. I mean, we looked alike, we did everything together, and he just basically keeled over at his desk. And I'm like, wow, is that going to happen to me? So I was trying to be very careful as a 57-year-old. Of course, it wasn't related, but you don't know that. You don't know what's going on. So so I don't know if he had the gene for cutis lax. I assume he did, because my mom, it's a first generation Italian American, and she made it to 90. So I'm like, no, not her. And so you don't know where else so I started doing it with my daughters, my other daughter too, who I'm very close to, and my son for that matter, doing genetic research. And so we got involved with Ancestry, and we've traced our family back, and we have another grandmother that died at 22 from a heart dissection. And we're like, oh. That, so now it starts raising flags, and it's been so long ago, it's 100 years ago, you have no way to go back and research it. You just have to kind of make some guesses and move on. And so I'm the oldest now of my generation, the only really surviving relative that potentially has it, so I don't have anywhere to go. So I start the process, and then we use me as kind of the guinea pig, and I'm fine with that. I'm like, yeah, let's learn what we can learn. So we keep learning new things.
Right. I understand you have also, before your diagnosis as an adult, a background in science, that you have some education, may not have been biology and medicine. Do you think that prepared you at all to look for information about your possible diagnosis, or did you find that there's just so little information out there that it was still a challenge no matter what your background.
Yeah, it was. And I'm really a technology guy. So I've always been, for the most of my career, I was developing healthcare systems and the kind of things you do for claims processing or Medicare systems, whatnot. I was very active in that space. So I was exposed to healthcare, but not genetics at all. And I really, as I often say, I had to wait until I grew my own genetic counselor to start learning about this stuff. So I had to wait for Dawn to take me as a patient. And that's when I got really interested. And when I put Think Genetic together, I knew that I could use technology to get better information, but I didn't know about genetics. So I went to Dawn and said, you know, I can do the technical side. Can you do the medical side? And so that's what we did, is we put together both of our expertises. So I've learned over the years, like I volunteer at, she volunteers at, she's an expert in Fabry disease and a lot of others, but that's the one that she's primarily treats. So I go to Fabry camp every year and meet the parents and the kids. And it's amazing how similar our stories are, even though the diseases are totally unrelated. It's the same journey. And when they see me and say, oh, you've made it this far, so that gives them, you know, encouragement that maybe they can do it too. So I find that fascinating. So I learn a lot of things by that. And I have doctors on the foundation board. So, you know, they're always, it's kind of funny, they're talking to me about it. And I've gone, because we've done in the foundation several studies of rare genetic diseases. So I got certified as a PI, as an investigator, so that I could lead one of these studies. So I obviously can't do the medical part, but I'm a good project manager, so I can get the right resources and do the study. So I learned that way as well. So that's exciting for me, just learning about different conditions in addition to cutis laxa. So
I know we're all very aware that it's so easy to Google our symptoms, and when we get a little inkling that something is wrong and our doctor is saying, you have this, or we see this, but we don't really know what's causing it.
Right.
A lot of times we haven't grown our own genetic counselor.
Exactly.
Yeah. All we have is the internet. I think it's interesting to know that even with someone at home and your exposure to the medical field and sort of knowing, how those systems operate, it sounds like you also had a struggle collecting information. And that was part of the inspiration for what you and Dawn would do later.
Yes.
Can you speak more to what exactly did come up when you were trying to find reasons for having an aortic dilation?
I'd say, you know, the first place that a lot of people run is WebMD, which is not a bad thing. It's just more general, and it's not focused on genetics. So what we found is we started using machine learning, artificial intelligence, to look at the wealth of data that's out on the internet. And what we found is there's good and there's bad. The problem is it's not focused on genetics. So if you're going to get good answers, you've got to start with good data. And when you have all data, then the algorithms are not sure which data is good and which is not. So they look for the things that occur the most, and that kind of sorts to the top, and that's what you get. So we found that when we were building Think Genetic, we thought we could just consume all data, all medical data, and then we'd be able to find it. But what we found is there's a concept called ground truth, which is what is the data set that you actually look at for your answers. And there was nothing that was in the genetic space, so we had to build that ground truth over time, and that's what we did. So we started with, that's why it's taken a long time. Start with the disease, genetic counselors, geneticist, and we build up the content about that condition, everything we can learn about it. And it's interesting, the most important question that people will ask on our site is, how is it to live with this condition? How long am I going to live with this? Is it going to kill me? That's 50% of the questions, guaranteed. And then there's others about, tell me about the diagnosis. And, you know, the next thing will be, well, I have this symptom, like in my case, I had a thyroid problem. Was that related to cutis laxa, or I just have a thyroid problem? You know, I don't know. So you have doubt in everything you look at, because you start thinking about, well, everything could be genetically related, and you don't know. And the doctors won't know either. That. So, you know, I had to see a specialist, and I've been on a treatment for my thyroid for years now. Is it related to cutis laxa? I still keep asking the question. Don't know. Don't know. And it's funny because the support group, there are 500, I mentioned 500 people's in the group. So the last time we had a meeting, I said, anybody else have thyroid problems? Just curious. And about 50 hands went up. And I went,
Oh,
oh,
yeah.
oh.
Right. You see
You know?
patterns like that out
Yeah.
among patients or people you know, and you start to wonder, is there a correlation that just hasn't been turned up in that, as you say, the ground truth?
No, it's true. And I've had three bouts of serious pneumonia out of nowhere. I mean, healthy walking around, all of a sudden I can't get up. And the last time it happened, I was on a, seems like it always happens when I'm in Texas, which I don't know what that means. I was in Houston and I was doing an assignment for a week and I was just wrapping up and the next day I was going to go home. And that evening I started feeling flush and then my fever started spiking and it went up to 106. And I only know this because I was able to get to the front desk and they thought I'd come from the bar and I was drunk. And I'm like, no, you need to get me to the hospital. Something's wrong. And so they got the fever down, did all kinds of tests and whatnot. 2 days later, I went home. Everything had gone away. It's like, well, what was that? I don't know. I just don't know. But yeah, when I got back to Boston again, they did all kinds of tests and trying to figure out, well, how's that related? And by then, they knew about the aneurysm. So of course, first thing they did was check the heart and make sure I hadn't done something there. But that's exactly right. That I'm a big proponent of genetic counselors, by the way. I don't know why. Maybe because I raised one, but you know. I think they're not appreciated for the knowledge base that they have, and often not by the medical community, which just absolutely floors me that they're viewed, I guess because of the title, they think of them as a counselor, like an emotional support group or something, not that you have all this medical training, and much more than a doctor would normally have, especially in genetics. So anyway, you know that. I know that, but the industry doesn't know that. They're learning.
Yes, and I know listeners to the Patient Stories podcast are aware of that too. And I'm curious how that integrates with Think Genetic, which is sort of, I think, bridging that gap a little bit. I'm not really sure how, if someone and anyone out in the world, if they're experiencing a diagnostic odyssey or they're wondering what's going on with them. And they're not sure if they should see a genetic counselor, or maybe they haven't even heard of one. If
Right.
they were to come across Think Genetic, how might they engage with that?
That well, we're not really. Well, that's not true. The foundation has content that interacts with potential patients, and it would basically tell them if this sounds like there's stories in there about particular diseases, but there aren't enough diseases. So 300 out of 9,000 is just not enough. But what we will say is, if you can't seem to get an answer, a genetic counselor might be a good answer, and we give them some resources to go to, whether that's a virtual genetic counselor, so there are associations that do that, or see your doctor and talk to him about maybe or her about seeing a genetic counselor. That's generally the first place I push people for. If you don't know what's going on, the doctor only has 15 minutes with you, and they're going to treat what they see. I'm not, it's not a criticism. That's what they're trained to do. But a genetic counselor is going to do a lot more workup to try and figure things out. And if they suspect it's genetic, then they're at least going to do some follow-up testing and to help you to get that problem solved. Yeah, it is. I know there was a TV show just a couple of years ago about they were doing genetic kinds of patients and pulling together a big group to figure out for somebody that has some unknown thing, maybe it's genetic, can we help them figure out what it is? And then there are others where you can crowdsource your symptoms and get answers that way. And I think everybody's trying to get at the same thing. It's like it's not normal, it's not going to be obvious. And what you're really hoping is you meet somebody just like you, because that's how you're going to find out that it's diagnosed. You meet somebody just like you that has gotten a diagnosis. So I'll even say, like, with my cutis laxa diagnosis now, I can look at a person and tell 90% of sure they have cutis laxa. I mean, it's just, you just see it. It's just so, and that's what Dawn said. Once I was diagnosed, yeah, it's just obvious that it may not be that, but it's connective tissue and it's probably that. And then you're on the right track. That's, you just want to get headed in a direction. Just somebody help me. Please talk to me. Not think I'm crazy or worse, that I'm a hypochondriac. So one of the most common things in cutis laxa from that I learned from the support group is plastic surgery, because you have very loose skin. So it might be on your arms, it might be on your hips, it might be on your eyelids. So like I can pull my eyelids down over my cheek if I choose to. And my kids always thought that was a great feature when they were growing up. And I would tell them, well, you got to put it back after you pull it down. It's not going anywhere. It won't retract. So, you know, just knowing those kinds of things.
Yeah, there are a lot of things that people will come across outside of their doctor's office visit, right?
Yeah, exactly. Totally. Totally. It's almost always that kind of a journey. Well, I think the biggest level journey is, have you thought about it, might be genetic. Do you have anybody in your family history that has things like you have? Because that's the first stop. And then if that's true, then, you know, I'm heading for a genetic counselor in that area. If I can figure out what, you know, kind of a general area of what it is, somebody that specializes in that kind of thing. So like with Dawn, it would be lysosomal storage diseases. So if you've got a problem with you don't sweat, or you've got swirls in your eye, or, you know, I don't know, kidney problems. So just, they lead to a different thing than I'm just sick, because that's not it.
Mm-hmm.
That's just not it. And you keep going back to the doctor for the same complaint, you know, month after month, year after year, and they give you all kinds of treatments, but you continue to show up with the same problem, same symptom. So that when I see that recurring thing, and we do that when we're looking at health records, a recurring problem indicates it might be genetic. If it keeps coming back and they're not having any luck, it's obviously misdiagnosed. And the question is now, is it genetic?
Did you find that any of the tools you were using in that time were very helpful for you, or like anything you came to Dawn or your physician about?
Physician, zero. I took, once I had the diagnosis, I went the next year. So I was getting an echocardiogram once a year to watch the growth of this aneurysm. So I don't remember which year, fourth year, fifth year. I took Dawn with me. And I said, oh, by the way, doc, it's genetic. And I would really like to talk to somebody about the surgery you're going to do, because I have soft tissue and I'm not going to be like all the other people who has an aneurysm repair. And I would just like to know, to talk to someone. And he basically referred us to their genetics department. That all he knew, what he said was, I'm going to repair the aneurysm when it's time. That was it. But to his credit, that's not totally true. When I actually was assigned a surgeon, the surgeon that I got for the aneurysm repair had come from Johns Hopkins from the connective tissue unit. So he heard me. And it made a huge difference when we were doing the consult the week before the surgery. He was explaining to me how they were going to do it and what they were going to do and how they replaced the aorta and all that kind. I mean, it's pretty fascinating. If it wasn't me, it would have been fun to do. But learning about how far the industry had come and what he could explain to me about that it was going to be okay, that the cutis laxa was not going to affect the surgery, and here are the things we're going to be looking for, here where there might be problems that we can address, that kind of thing. So it made a huge difference just to be able to talk about. He understood.
Right. And if they hadn't known that you had that, they may have been counseling you on a different set of risks or outcomes that could have resulted from.
Yeah, yeah, I think that you just don't know. And I don't know that it made any difference at all, you know. So I'd ask, as only I could do, right? I said, well, when you take that out, can I see the aneurysm? I want to see what it looks like. And how long was it going to be before it dissected? And they're like, no, you can't have any of that. It's going to the lab. I'm like, oh, after 15 years, I said, at least, you know, I'm curious. I just want to know. Anyway.
Yeah. That curiosity has been a string through this, I think, since.
It is. I didn't get to see my rib either when they took that out. So it's like, come on.
Oh, that's not fair.
Oh, well.
Well, thank you for sharing the story of your journey. I think that it resonates with a lot of people, and it can also teach those in the field, both genetic counseling and medicine at large, what this could look like, especially if you have a patient that is educated and kind of knows how things go. I think it illustrates that there's still a lot that's unknown, and putting the pieces together is not a simple task.
Right. No, it's true. Yeah, I think you're your own best advocate, so you better take control of that part of it.
But right.
You do have a lot of expertise that people are going to try and help you, but there's also a lot of people that don't, especially in genetics, that don't have the knowledge yet, that smart people that just don't know that part. So.
One last thing I'd like to ask about, because I do know a lot of genetic counselors and people who would like to get into genetic counseling. And as we went over in the story, the importance and just how much of a difference it can make in people's lives, especially if they're going through a journey like this. Genetic counseling Can you tell me a little bit about the Think Genetic Foundation and what it's doing right now?
So the Think Genetic Foundation, what we found was that when the for-profit company, Think Genetic Inc., when they would identify someone that probably is at risk for a genetic condition, somehow you've got to get them over into the health system and you've got to educate them on the problem. You also have to educate the health system on the problem, and I shouldn't say the problem, on the condition. How do you do that? And so I formed the foundation to say, well, we need to train people. And so we do lunch and learns. This year we sent, I want to say 50, 55 genetic counselors to the national conference they have every year, that we paid for them to go to those conferences, saying that a lot of times genetic counselors don't have the money because of where they are to go to these conferences to upgrade their education, even though they already know a lot of things and with colleagues. So the foundation is all about getting money from pharmaceutical companies will give us money to educate physicians, patients, others, to raise awareness of the conditions they care about. And sometimes you can do more general than that. That's what we hope to do, is we don't want to be tied into a particular condition, but we're glad to help them. So that's what the foundation does. We also have done some PI-led studies where we would investigate. We've done one on HAE, figuring out if you could look at medical records and get some prognosis that there are some people that need to be tested and they might have this particular condition. And we use experts in the field to do that, and then we basically publish at the next conference. I don't remember where that one was published, but on the results of what we found. So how well did the algorithms work? What happened to the patients? Anything else we can tell? Because we don't actually know the patients. We shouldn't know the patients. We're not their primary care. But we can get to the point of getting them into the healthcare system and then following their journey. So to the extent they want to talk to us. So those are the two things basically the foundation does. So we'll do directed studies. Pharma will give us money to go do a one-year study on some condition. And then the other is education things, where we run these webinars and send people to conferences that we think will help them become more effective in their field.
Patient Stories is an ad-free podcast and is unaffiliated with any genetic testing laboratories. We would like to keep it that way. To support the podcast with a donation, visit graygenetics.com/podcast/donate. If you would like to dig deeper into the professional issues raised by these patient stories, for $5 a month, you can join the Patient Stories Club. To sign up, look for the link in the podcast notes for this episode or visit graygenetics.com/podcast.
The information contained in this podcast does not constitute medical advice and is also not a substitute for genetic counseling. Neither Gray Genetics nor any of its guests makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the statements or any information contained in this podcast. Evaluation of an individual's personal and family health history is a crucial part of genetic counseling and any recommendations.